Stand by for the fastest 60 minutes in Jewish radio. It's time for the Jewish Experience. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. Well, now Shas is still in the government after promising to leave. So Olmert still reigns and Israel still withers. And your Jewish Experience radio program just turned 3 years old. Yay! Well, it's now Chazaka. Hi, everyone. I'm Hirsch Delin, your host. You are tuned in to Pittsburgh's only Jewish radio program, The Jewish Experience. Parsha this week is Tetzava. Last week we learned how to build a Mishkan in the desert, but now we have to find out how to build a Kohen that will serve in the Mishkan. Well, not really build one, but dress one. But first, Hashem tells Moshe to take pure olive oil and light the seven-branch menorah, which is going to be an everlasting flame that Aaron is to keep burning morning and evening. Now, this is not the menorah we burn on Hanukkah to remember the miracle of the oil. That menorah has eight branches, and the one in the temple has seven. But they both do use pure olive oil. So, just what was required for the Kohen to wear? Well, first he wore a ketonis, a full-length linen tunic, and then a michnasayim, a linen breeches, then a nefes, which was a linen turban, and finally an avnus, which was a long sash worn around the waist. We actually commemorate that part of the priestly garment by wearing a gartel today during davening. Now, the head priest, the Kohen Gadol, wore, in addition to all that, the ephod, which was like an apron made of blue, purple, and red dye, wool, linen, and gold thread, and the Choshen, which contained 12 stones, which had the names of the 12 tribes inscribed in them, and the Me'il, which was a cloak of blue wool with gold bells and pomegranates on the hem, and finally the Tzitz, which was a golden plate on the forehead with the words Kodesh Lashem, Holy to God, inscribed on it. And the Torah describes the seven-day initiation that Aaron and his sons had to go through and how the golden altar, the Mizbeag Zahav, was made and where the Ketoris was burned. And speaking of burning, the staff of the JE is burning up with excitement to get you into the program today with Rabbi Meir Goldwasser, Moshe Bakar, Rabbi Yosef Eisen, Ms. Devorah DeLynn reporting from Israel, and Dr. Michael Shulman with your musical selections chosen today by Ms. Pearlie DeLynn. Sit back and enjoy 60 minutes of the best Jewish radio in southwestern Pennsylvania. Our special guest today is Alan Gottlieb, who heads up the Second Amendment Foundation. He's going to bring us up to date on the importance of self-defense as a community and how the constitutional guarantees to keep and bear arms relate to the Jewish communities today. Of course, we'll have your community announcements and mazel tovs along with current news fresh from Israel National Radio coming up in the half hour. Now, forget, you can always find us on the web at JewishExperienceRadio.com. Now, forget to sponsor part of your program to honor a simcha or to remember a yahrzeit. Your help keeps the JE on the air. As always, we thank our regular sponsors, Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, Next Generation Financial Services, First Mariner Bank, Pittsburgh Simcha Orchestra, and Artistic Photography. And don't forget, candlelighting time tonight, 5:36 p.m. with an insight on this week's Parsha is our resident rabbi, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser.
Last week in the Torah, we read about the building of the Mishkan, the holy sanctuary that traveled with the Jewish people as they went through the desert. This week, we read about the special garments that Aaron, the Kohen Gadol, wore, and the garments that his sons, the Kohanim, wore. Every Jew gave two donations toward the building of the Mishkan. One donation was for the Adonim, the foundation of the Mishkan. For this donation, everyone had to give a like amount, a half of a shekel. For the Mishkan itself, for the wood and the curtains and the different vessels, everyone gave as much as they could afford. And the obvious question is, why was there this difference? We know that every Jew is obligated to make of themselves a dwelling place for Hashem. We see this in the Pasuk. The Torah says, V'osu li mikdosh, and you shall make for me a sanctuary, V'shochanti b'solchom, that I may dwell in them. And the sages note the change of tense in the Pasuk. The Pasuk begins in the singular, V'osu li mikdosh, you shall make for me a sanctuary. But then it concludes in the plural, V'shochanti b'solchom, that I may dwell in them. And from this we see that Hashem wishes to dwell in each and every person. What is the foundation of our Mishkan? The Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shemaim, the acceptance of the yoke of the kingdom of heaven. This necessarily must be the foundation of our Mishkan. And in this, everyone is alike, whether it be Moshe Rabbeinu or a young child. Both of them must serve Hashem with Kabbalas Ol. Since in our spiritual Mishkan, everyone is alike, that is the reason why in the physical Mishkan, everyone gave a like amount for the foundation. What is the spiritual counterpart of the Mishkan in every person's service to Hashem? That is each individual's talents that Hashem gave to them. What is required is that each one gives their utmost. As Reb Zusha said, he isn't afraid when he comes to heaven that they will ask him why he didn't serve Hashem like Moshe Rabbeinu. He will simply say, I wasn't given the talents of Moshe Rabbeinu. But what he is afraid is that they will ask him why he didn't serve Hashem as Reb Zusha. Why didn't he serve Hashem with all of the talents and ability that were given to Reb Zusha? Since in each individual's Mishkan, everyone must do their utmost, this is the reason why in the physical Mishkan, everyone had to give as much as they were able to afford.
Retirement can be a wonderful reward for years of hard work, but it can also be stressful as you deal with questions about how to maintain your standard of living while protecting what you worked so hard for. What if I told you that you could generate extra cash flow without touching a penny of your savings, investments, or current income? If you or someone you love is 62 years or older and owns their own home, they may be able to take advantage of a federally regulated program called a home equity conversion mortgage or reverse mortgage. Seniors all across the U.S. are using reverse mortgages to increase their cash flow for purchasing long-term care insurance, putting grandkids through college, making charitable donations, paying off credit card debt, paying for prescription drugs, buying vacation homes, and paying for much-needed home repair. Call for a free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet today. Get the facts and help yourself and your family through a reverse mortgage. Call Andy at 412-562-2220 for a free copy while supplies last. Again, that number is 412-562-2220 for your free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet. First Mariner Bank is an equal housing lender. All around us, life is moving faster and faster. Things are changing all the time, and it's a comfort to know in your time of need that at Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, the Jewish tradition continues. Burton Hirsch Funeral Home has served the Pittsburgh Jewish community since 1947 and has recently remodeled its entire facility to better serve you. Burton Hirsch Funeral Directors are members of the Jewish Funeral Directors Association and work closely with area rabbis to ensure that your needs as a Jewish family are totally met. Their attentive and compassionate guidance results in treating each family as their own. I personally met with Michael Hilgefort. And did you know that Burton Hirsch Funeral Home is even involved with community educational programs to ensure that Jewish families know what to do to have a proper burial? In your time of special need, call Squirrel Hill's only Jewish funeral home, Burton Hirsch, at 412-521-2600. That's 412-521-2600. They welcome your request to visit and tour their state-of-the-art facilities. Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, proud sponsors of the Jewish Experience, 412-521-2600. Now it's time for A Moment in Jewish History with the author of Miraculous Journey, Rabbi Yosef Eisen.
Jews first came to the British Isles about 1,000 years ago from the existing Ashkenazic communities in northern France. They became bankers and financiers and controlled much of England's wealth, lending vast sums of money to the church, the nobility, and even the crown. One Jew, Aaron of Lincoln, was so wealthy that upon his death, the government established a special department to dispose of his assets. The Jews settled throughout England, but London had the largest concentration of Jews. Jewish money lending and vast wealth aroused great resentment among the British people. At the coronation ceremony of Richard the Lionheart as King of England in 1189 at Westminster Abbey in London, riots broke out against the Jewish delegation and quickly spread throughout the country. Jews were killed in many places, and the jubilant mobs burned the records of the debts owed to the Jews. The most infamous of these pogroms took place in the city of York, where 150 Jews barricaded themselves into a castle known as Clifford's Tower and fought off a rabid mob for weeks. When the Jews saw they could not hold out any longer, they committed mass suicide upon the advice of their spiritual leader, the great Rabbi Yom Tov of Yugni. Clifford's Tower still stands today, and a plaque commemorates the massacre that took place there. In 1290, the Jews were expelled from England, not to return until the late 1600s. It is noteworthy that William Shakespeare, who wrote the anti-Semitic The Merchant of Venice, may have never seen a Jew, as he lived in the 1500s when there were no Jews in England. In the mid-1600s, a great rabbi in Amsterdam, Menashe ben Yisrael, convinced Oliver Cromwell, Lord Protector of England, that the return of Jews to England would be a fulfillment of the biblical prophecy of Daniel, which states that Mashiach will come when the Jews are gathered to the ends of the world. As the French name for England is Angleterre, which means the edge of the world, this argument impressed the Bible-loving Puritans very much. Cromwell presented the idea to Parliament, which, fearful of Jewish competition to Christian merchants, refused. However, Jews were allowed to enter England unofficially. In the 1660 Restoration, when Charles II became King of England, he repaid Jews who had supported him in exile by officially allowing Jews into England. Thereafter, the community expanded rapidly.
Now, from the Israel National Radio Newsroom, here's Ernie Singer.
Attorney and Temple Mount activist Baruch Ben Yosef has called for a public campaign by leading rabbis against the Muslim presence on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Ben Yosef dismissing claims by Rabbi Shmuel Rabinovich, who oversees the western wall of the temple and other holy sites, that the Muslim destruction of the Temple Mount is not as bad as it used to be. Asked by Arut Sheva about the electrical cable ditch that was dug by heavy machinery several months ago, Rabbi Rabinovich saying, "There was indeed an authorized dig like that, but when we discovered finds from the first temple period there, the diggers were asked to change the ditch's route, and they complied." Quoting Ben Yosef, "It is time for the Jews to cease living their lives in a world of make-believe. The destruction exists, it is ongoing, and it will continue as long as Muslims set foot on the mount." Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni and the heads of the PLO negotiating team have expressed opposition to Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's efforts to delay talks on Jerusalem until the final stages of negotiations between the two sides, according to the Haaretz Daily. Senior PLO negotiator Ahmed Karia says he's fully authorized to place all core issues on the negotiating table without exception and without setting priorities. The head of the PLO's negotiating department, Dr. Saeb Erekat, has told the newspaper that it is not possible to discuss certain matters without discussing Jerusalem. Quoting Erekat, "The border issue cannot advance without addressing Jerusalem's borders. As far as we're concerned, Har Choma, Givat Ze'ev, and Maale Adumim are not part of Jerusalem, and Jewish neighborhoods like Ramot and Gilo are settlements for all intents and purposes." Erekat says the negotiations have not really begun, as the sides waste most of the time on procedural issues, uprooting outposts and suspending what he called settlement activity. He denied reports about a secret channel between Vice Premier Chaim Ramon and businessman Mohammed Rashid, adding that Rashid has not been authorized by anyone to conduct talks. Livni writing this past week to the head of the Jerusalem City Council opposition near Barkat that it was established in Annapolis last year that Israel and the PLO would conduct negotiations on all the core issues, in her words, with no exception. Livni also writing that the talks are proceeding according to the agreement that, in her words, until everything is agreed on, nothing is agreed on. The newspaper says this means that the order of the debates on the core issues is insignificant, as without an understanding on Jerusalem, any understandings reached on other issues are meaningless. The newspaper quoting a senior European source that says the talks' slow pace and Israel's foot dragging on its promises to remove roadblocks and uproot outposts could lead to the PLO's collapse in a short time. The source said Arab and European donor states conditioned their aid to the PLO on free movement of people and merchandise in the PLO-assigned areas. A majority of Israelis want the military to launch a large-scale operation against terrorist missile squads in Hamas-controlled Gaza, according to a poll of 500 people conducted by the Telesecret Company for the Ma'ariv Daily on Friday. Israel has been battling the terrorists with pinpoint operations and airstrikes, but the continuing missile fire has drawn increasing calls for a major army invasion. The government has been hesitant to approve such an operation so far because of the likelihood it would result in the deaths of a large number of soldiers and civilians and still might not succeed in halting the rockets. In the Yediot Ahronot Daily's weekend edition, former Chief of Staff Don Chalutz of the Israel Defense Forces also had some words of caution, saying that, in his words, "If one of the options is to take over Gaza, we'd need to know until when and what the reason to withdraw would be." Asked about Israel's lack of preparedness for the 2006 Lebanon War, as documented by the Army and the Vinograd Commission, Chalutz said, quoting once again, "I wasn't surprised by the problem, I was surprised by the potency of it. The IDF's state of preparedness did not manifest itself by a lack of water or a lack of bullets. There is something deeper there that stems from, among other things, the fact that the IDF has been involved in missions that are not purely military ones for the past 20 years. 20 years is a generation. The commanders of today were born into this reality." Defensible borders in the age of missiles, one of the topics at the Jerusalem Conference, co-sponsored by Israel National News, February 19th and 20th. Shabbat, Yud of the 10th of Adar Aleph on the Jewish calendar, and the weather forecast, partly cloudy and slightly warmer through Sunday in most places, light rain in the north and light snow on the Hermon starting on Shabbat. The rain spreading to the northern Negev Sunday night, Monday very cold and stormy with snow spreading to the central hilltops. Ernie Singer, Israel National Radio.
That was a look at Jerusalem weather, and now for your local weather, here's meteorologist Glenn Foxen.
A beautiful Shabbos is in store for us Pittsburghers as high pressure settles in over southwest Pennsylvania. It will be cold, high temperatures 30 to 35 degrees on Shabbos day. The next chance of wintry weather will come on Sunday into Sunday night, and again on Monday. The forecast for Pittsburgh and vicinity. Friday night, mostly cloudy, colder, low temperature around 15. Shabbos and Motzi Shabbos, Partly cloudy, high temperatures around 30, the low temperatures around 20. On Sunday, mostly cloudy with rain likely during the afternoon, high around 40. Sunday night, rain likely in the evening, then snow after midnight. A light accumulation of snow is possible. Low temperatures in the low 30s. On Monday, cloudy with snow showers likely in the morning and afternoon. Again, a light accumulation of snow is possible. Temperatures will be steady in the mid-30s. This has been meteorologist Glenn Foxon wishing everyone good weather and great times this Shabbos.
We want to wish our brothers and sisters in the Holy Land a very peaceful and restful Shabbat.
It's time for the Mazel Tovs, and I hope you enjoyed Leva last week. We got a lot of emails about that, and I'm glad you all did, and hopefully we'll have her back again real soon. This week, Mr. and Mrs. Brad Perlman on the engagement of their daughter, Golda, to Mendy Schreiber. Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov. And Mr. and Mrs. Mark and Vera Sperling on the birth of a grandchild. And take a look at some events around the community. Coming up this summer, full-service Jewish day camp with hot lunches and two daily snacks included. 6 weeks, June 25th through August 5th, 7 hours. Day camp, 9 to 4 p.m., three divisions with a mini camp, a primary camp, and the famed Pioneer Program. Great staff trips, daily excitement, fully loaded website, cgipittsburgh.com. Early bird discount is over because that ended February 13th, but maybe you can talk to them. You never know. CGI Pittsburgh for the summer of a lifetime. Call Rabbi Shmuley Rothman, camp director, at 412-715-4883 for more information. Are You My Mother? Jewish Perspectives on Conception and Pregnancy with Rabbi Levi Langer is Sunday, February 17th. That's this Sunday, 7:30 p.m. at Congregation Polizetic, corner of Phillips and Shady. A tribute to the memory of Mr. Ed Lewis, founder and former CEO of Oxford Development, will take place at the 64th Annual Dinner of Yeshiva Schools, Tuesday, March 4th, at the Hilton Hotel. Call Mindy for more information, 412-422-7300. Doctors Joel and Tova Weinberg will be honored at the Kollel Annual Manava Maka, March 1st at 8:45 p.m. Call 412-420-0220 for information and tickets. ZOA Pittsburgh, in partnership with the United Jewish Federation and the Shaliach's office, presents Did Herzl Really Say That? Conversation Israel. A new series of films straight from Israel called Deborah at the ZOA. For more details, 412-665-4630. Also at ZOA Pittsburgh presents Eye on Israel, a six-part course designed to help you think analytically and develop a critical eye regarding what you read, see, and hear about Israel in the media. Again, call Deborah at the newly invigorated and energized ZOA, 412-665-4630. The meeting of Food Addicts Recovery Anonymous meets at the Pittsburgh Kollel, 5808 Beacon Street, every Sunday evening from 7:30 to 9 p.m. Program is a recovery group for people who cannot control their eating and or their weight. Not for women only. Men are invited. For more information, call Ilana at 412-422-2224. And, of course, if you'd like to have your Mazel Tovs on our program, you can do it. And, of course, your events as well. Give us a call at 412-979-5770 or drop us an email at jewishexperience@verizon.net by noon on Monday for that week's program. Now, we got candlelighting time this week's 5:36 p.m. Stay tuned for the Jewish founder of the Second Amendment Foundation, up next, right after this. Retirement can be a wonderful reward for years of hard work, but it can also be stressful as you deal with questions about how to maintain your standard of living while protecting what you worked so hard for. What if I told you that you could generate extra cash flow without touching a penny of your savings, investments, or current income? If you or someone you love is 62 years or older and owns their own home, they may be able to take advantage of a federally regulated program called a home equity conversion mortgage or reverse mortgage. Seniors all across the U.S. are using reverse mortgages to increase their cash flow for purchasing long-term care insurance, putting grandkids through college, making charitable donations, paying off credit card debt, paying for prescription drugs, buying vacation homes, and paying for much-needed home repair.
Call for a free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet today. Get the facts and help yourself and your family through a reverse mortgage. Call Andy at 412-562-2220 for a free copy while supplies last. Again, that number is 412-562-2220 for your free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet. First Mariner Bank is an equal housing lender. Very pleased to have with us today Mr. Alan Gottlieb, who is the founder of the Second Amendment Foundation. And to my surprise, after talking with Alan, I found out he's also an owner of many radio stations, an advertising agency, numerous other businesses, publishers of magazines. This guy is unbelievable. Alan, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Hirsch.
I'm glad you could take a few minutes out of your day for this. It's incredible. The Second Amendment Foundation is something that's actually new to me and probably new to many of our listeners. Most of them are familiar with the NRA and maybe Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. Tell us where the Second Amendment Foundation fits in, what makes it different, and how the Jewish community of Pittsburgh can relate to what you're doing.
Well, probably the Second Amendment Foundation fits in the niche that we're an educational research, legal defense, public education foundation. So we have a 501c3 tax status, which like the NRA and Jews for the Preservation of the Second Amendment does not have.
Mm-hmm.
And we're basically the nation's oldest foundation dedicated to gun rights. We were founded in 1974. We have about 650,000 members and contributors nationwide.
Hmm, wow.
And we're sort of in a lot of ways like a civil rights organization.
So does the NRA, let's say, maybe JPFO, do they use you as a resource?
Yeah, I think they do use us as a resource, but we also work together. We hold every year a national gun rights policy conference that we move around the country, and they both participate in it, you know, all the time, and so they're involved with some of our activities, and we cross-pollinate.
Okay, so you're really more educational, and the others, I guess, more action-oriented. I don't know, do you get involved in the political scene at all?
No, we do not get directly involved in the political scene. That would be the difference.
Okay.
Because of our tax status.
I was going to say that would violate the tax status. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the Second Amendment, and many people listening to the program, we have a big mix here, and we talk about the Second Amendment being something where, obviously, it talks about militias first, and then it said the right to bear arms shall not be infringed. So, thinking about the history of the Jewish people, and obviously, being a minority in most countries that they're in, being an oppressed minority in some countries that they're in, obviously, the right to keep and bear arms, I would think, would be important. Can you elaborate a little bit on the Second Amendment, why it's probably not necessary for the militia part of it, but it is necessary for the at least the right to be able to keep and bear arms, and why it's that's important to keep that maintained?
Let me start by saying, first of all, that the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The right of the people to keep and bear arms not be infringed is not really contingent on the militia. And in fact, if the government abolished the militia, the right to keep and bear arms would still exist. And militia has been defined in many times, and it's basically the people as a whole, both when it was written and in various updates and congressional bills that have been passed over the years.
Mm-hmm.
It's really probably important, to me it's important to everybody, Jewish or not Jewish. But I think, quite frankly, looking at the fact that the Holocaust and Nazi Germany, you know, they registered guns, and then they basically registered Jews. And they sort of banned guns, and they tried to make Jews extinct, which is the same thing sort of as banning something. And quite frankly, if you want to defend yourself, I mean, a firearm is about the only way, the ultimate way to do it. It doesn't matter if it's a government that goes crazy, or if it's street criminals, or if it's, you know, Middle Eastern terrorists. The bottom line is that when it comes to protecting yourself and your family, to me it's your obligation, and a firearm is the best means to do it.
Okay. And, of course, there's a very famous saying that says, armed you're a citizen, unarmed you're a subject. When the government, I forget the other one where it says something like, well, the government should fear you, you not fear the government. But it's also a Torah principle as well, is it not, that it says if somebody comes to kill you, it's very, very clear about it. It says you should kill him first. And that principle itself would seem like it would be almost incumbent upon the Jewish community to at least have programs, have educational sources where people have the opportunity, if they wish, to learn and be up on the proper use of a firearm. In any case,
yeah, I would agree. I think there's no doubt that the Torah basically put self-defense on a pretty high level. That it's not only to me a right, but sort of an obligation that you had that obligation to defend yourself. And so, by all means, again, a firearm is the best way to do it. It's interesting that in the gun rights movement, as well as in the anti-gun rights movement, many, or if not most of the leaders of the organizations tend to be Jewish.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
On both sides of the debate.
Right, I've noticed that. Well, of course, in almost every kind of activist organization, the Jews are in there somewhere because they seem to be very community active, just in, as so to speak, in the genes.
Yeah, what I love, of course, is when I get an anti-Semitic hate letter in the mail to me, you know, about how all the Jews want to take our guns away.
Right, right.
They don't realize they wrote somebody running an organization who happens to be Jewish.
Yeah.
I find it kind of amusing sometimes.
Well, also, you know, we talk about the Bill of Rights and the importance, of course, and how Jews have flourished in this country because of this. Many people think that they get their rights from government, and it's one of the most unbelievable things that we talk about. In fact, these rights are guaranteed by God, and that the Constitution is only guaranteeing that the government cannot take that right away. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I think the government is basically recognizing that you have certain God-given rights, and the government is there to protect those God-given rights. They don't give you those rights. Those rights don't emanate from government. They pre-exist government.
Exactly. So talk a little bit about some of the issues that you and your organization are working on now in terms of trying to maintain the Second Amendment in terms of not just education, but some of the policy briefs, some of the papers that you're working on today.
Well, some of the things we're really involved in right now are legal cases. And we just, in fact, this week filed our amicus curiae brief in the case of D.C. versus Heller to try and overturn the D.C. handgun ban, which is going before the U.S. Supreme Court. And oral arguments will be in March 18th. And we filed a very important brief in that case, and we've been, you know, involved in that case from the very beginning, and so we're looking forward to that one, determining that the Second Amendment is an individual right and that
sure.
A gun ban, in fact, does, in fact, violate that right.
Mm-hmm.
But we've also been involved. We just recently had a very big decision in San Francisco where the city of San Francisco banned handguns for the second time. They did it back in 1984, and we sued and overturned it. They changed the language thinking they could beat a court challenge again, and we just won again. We won in court already, but we just had the California Court of Appeals unanimously agree and uphold the decision overturning the ban again. So we had another victory knocking out a handgun ban in San Francisco.
Now, are you working on these when you do this? Are you working with, let's say, Gun Owners of America or some of these others as coalitions, or are you doing this on your own?
The one in San Francisco, we were a coalition member with the NRA, but Gun Owners was not involved in that one. And in the Supreme Court case for the D.C. gun ban, it's no gun group is doing the main case, but everybody is basically filing amicus and Gun Owners of America and the NRA, Second Amendment Foundation, Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep Your Arms, Jews for the Preservation of Arms Ownership, they've all filed briefs in that case as well. We have another one ongoing that we sort of have had victories in, but it's not over yet. That was against the city of New Orleans. When Hurricane Katrina hit, they went and started confiscating privately held firearms.
Unbelievable, right.
Without due cause. And we sued. We got a restraining order stopping them from doing it, and then we got an order returning them to return the firearms. And we're still in litigation with them because they've returned some of the firearms but haven't tried to return them all. So if a person isn't knocking on the door trying to grab their gun back, they're not going out of their way to return the guns that they know they've taken illegally from people and they know who the people are. And so we're still in litigation with the city of New Orleans over that. And we actually have been held in contempt of court because they refused to comply with some of the discovery. And finally, the federal courts got upset with them and held them in contempt and forced them to pay some of our legal fees.
Unbelievable. So, are you involved at all in the same kind of thing going on with the Washington D.C. case?
Yeah, we're directly involved with that case itself.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the lead attorney in the case directly, Alan Gura, is one of our attorneys that works on a number of our cases for us. In this particular case, he was doing that one sort of pro bono.
Sure.
In that case. And again, there's a Jewish attorney doing that case as well, and since we're talking to a Jewish audience.
Sure.
Is the lead attorney in that case, and actually two of the three lead attorneys are Jewish, all doing it pro bono in that case, and then the number of gun rights groups have stepped up to file amicus briefs in the case and help out.
Sure. Are these people also qualified to practice before the Supreme Court?
Yeah, you have to be, or you couldn't go this far with the case, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. How do you think that's going to come out?
I think we're going to win 6-3 or 7-2.
Mm-hmm.
We may win 9-0, but that would be on a technicality that under D.C. Home Rule they couldn't have passed it anyway. But on the Second Amendment issues, I think we're going to win 6-3 or 7-2.
Great, great. Well, that sounds good. Of course, now in the Jewish community, we have people, Alan, that are very observant. We have Orthodox people in the Jewish community in Pittsburgh who are very, very much ardent gun owners. Many of them do carry their weapons on Shabbos, and they have talked to rabbis who have told them that there are certain ways to do it. Are you familiar with any of this, and do you yourself carry on the Sabbath?
I myself do carry on the Sabbath, and I know there are some rabbis that definitely said it's okay to do so, and people that do. On the other hand, there's some people that don't feel comfortable doing it, and you know I understand that too. But I think it's pretty much of an individual decision. I think most of the rabbis have said, you know, it's not that you can, not that you can't, but it should be an individual decision.
Sure, especially in this place what they call an Erev, which is a makes a, what they call a reshus, makes a place that you go, a private kind of place, which means you can carry certain things that are necessary on the Sabbath. This would be considered necessary if you have the feeling, this is what they've used, I think, in the past, if you feel like you might be threatened in some way, or you feel like being in the synagogue, you want to be ready if, God forbid, something does happen. And there have been incidences. We had one in Pittsburgh where we have been challenged in that way, but we found out later on it wasn't actually, we thought it was a bomb threat, and it turned out it wasn't.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that houses of worship in general these days tend to be targets for extremists or crazy people. And it doesn't necessarily matter if it's a synagogue or if it's a church for that matter. And there's no doubt in my mind that these days at least somebody in the congregation needs to be armed to protect everybody else.
Sure. And of course, trained. What do you recommend in terms of training for, let's say, a family? When should a child start training? And what types of training should an adult go through? As a minimum.
I have four children, and my children were all trained at a fairly young age, mainly in the area, first of all, of respecting the firearm and knowing what it can do, and you know, and injuries it can cause, so that it's treated with respect. I've discovered with children that you know things that you tend to play with around is the forbidden fruit that you don't let them near.
Right.
That's the things they want to get their hands on as soon as you turn your back. So in my case, the firearms weren't, you know, so to speak, hidden. They were sort of like, you know, the kids were given the opportunity to, at an early age, learn how to use them properly. If they wanted to see them, just ask and you'll get to see them. It's not going to be hidden from you, so you don't have to go behind my back.
Exactly.
And I think that's a very important thing to do at an early age.
Exactly.
Then later on, of course, for training for both children, you know, and adults, is, you know, whatever, one, you know, range practice comes in very, very handy. And it depends on if you're going to get a license to carry a concealed firearm or not. If you're going to carry a concealed firearm, probably additional training is good to have, particularly in the areas of self-defense and situations that may arise. If you use a firearm for self-defense, usually, you know, it's not like behind a range where it's a quiet place and you're concentrating on a target. There are people moving, there are noises, there are sounds, there are unexpected things happening. And some training in those areas, I think, come in very, very handy. I've gone through that kind of training, but obviously not every gun owner does, because not every gun owner wants to carry.
Sure, exactly. Do you know anything about, as a final wrap-up here, any about the gun laws in Israel at all?
Gun laws in Israel are pretty liberal. I mean, a significant percentage of the Israeli population is armed.
Yes. The reason I bring it up, what I've heard is that the guns are owned by the government and lent to the people to carry. Have you heard anything about that?
Yes and no. Some people own guns privately, but the government does make guns available to various citizens, and the guns are then owned by the government, but you know, they're given to you to use. So the government's basically taking the position of policy that guns aren't evil, and that, you know, in fact, we will give them to the population. But lots of people choose other guns the government doesn't give out and want a different style, a different model, and they buy their own.
Sure. And, of course, if they give them out, they can always take them back. And that's the problem in this country with the registration.
Yeah, you have to always remember, a government that's big enough to give you everything you want is also big enough to take everything you've got away.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, before we run out of time, I want to be able to let people know how to get in touch with you and the Second Amendment Foundation if they want more information. So how do they do it?
Well, the best way to get more information, if you're on the web, of course, is to go to our website at saf.org. SAF for Second Amendment Foundation, or just go to any browser and put in Second Amendment Foundation on our webpage, will pop up. And if they'd like to call the office and request, you know, a pack of literature and information on the issue, we send it out free, and then the area code's 425-454-7012. That's 425-454-7012.
Okay, great. And Alan, just being a Jew and running this organization in your own community, do you take any heat for this?
Actually, there's a number of Jewish people that support what I do very heavily, and there's a number that don't. I think the ones that don't have come over the years to respect me, and so we agree to disagree, but there's a mutual respect.
Great. Yeah, well, with that, we'll wrap it up. Wish you a very good Shabbos. And,
well, thank you.
Once again, thank you for being with us on the Jewish Experience radio program.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
Take care. Be well.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And the Feminine Perspective this week is sponsored in honor of Ari Ben-Nina for success in his job and having gesund and parnosa for him and his children. And now, reporting from Israel, here's Devorah Dalin.
Zachor eis asher asa lecha Amalek baderech betzeischa mimitzrayim. Remember what Amalek did to you on your way out of Egypt. This Shabbos is Shabbos Zachor, the week we read about the war between the nation of Amalek and the Jews in the desert, and the command that we must totally annihilate them. There is no other nation on the face of this earth that we are commanded to destroy. What's so bad about Amalek that we must totally wipe them out? In order to comprehend this, we must first understand where the nation of Amalek came from. Esav, the brother of Yaakov Avinu, left his father's house and traveled to Har Seir, a city that was governed by a man named Seir. Esav had relations with Seir's wife, and they had a daughter named Timnah. Timnah heard of the greatness of her uncle Yaakov and wanted to marry him. Yaakov, of course, refused. He couldn't marry a mamzeres, a child from such a relationship. Seeking another way to attach herself to Yaakov's family, she offered herself as a concubine to her father Esav. From this union came Amalek, a mamzer ben mamzeres. Okay, we can see why such a person would be despised. But how can an entire nation deserve to be wiped out just because of the birth of their ancestor? The answer lies in the actions of the nation as a whole. When the Jewish people were coming out of Egypt, Amalek, who lived seven kingdoms away, came and attacked them. The verse uses the word kara, that they happened on the way. The nation wanted to show their utter disregard for Hashem. They forced themselves to believe that the world just happened, even after hearing of the miracles of the Exodus, and they showed the world their disrespect of Hashem by attacking the Jewish stragglers, the children, the elderly, and the women. Haman, the villain of the Purim story, came from such a nation. While it is true that Ahasuerus, the king of Persia, had no love for the Jews, Haman chose to push the king and paid him 10,000 measurements of silver to allow him to do this. The decree was sent out that there was to be a relentless attack against the Jews on the 14th of Adar. Esther, who had become queen, fasted for 3 days, commemorating the 3 days of complete faith that Avram Avinu took to walk to the binding of his son Yitzchak, in hope that Hashem would have mercy on them for Avraham's sake. There was a certain Jewish man who went to an Amaleki family and begged him to buy him and his family in order to save them from being massacred. The Amaleki man refused, for he was ordered not to buy Jews, just to kill them. Here the words in the book of Devarim, Deuteronomy, were fulfilled, "And you shall sell yourself to your enemies as servants and maids, and they will not buy." Haman and the nation of Amalek didn't stand to get any personal profit. In fact, Haman paid heavily for this privilege. Their blind hatred of us and blatant disrespect for Hashem is one of the reasons we are commanded to wipe them out. In the end of the story, we see the concept of Vinahapahu, that things were turned around. Haman, the sworn enemy himself, acknowledged that the Jews are Hashem's chosen nation. Instead of the Jews being killed, the Amalekim were killed for their plot. Fasting turned into feasting, sadness into joy. May we merit to have the sadness of exile be turned into the ultimate joy and feasting of the era of Mashiach Tzidkenu. Have a good Shabbos and a Freilichen Purim.
Yerushalayim beis mikdash chomzim hasoilo
Habiteinu letziyon Tziyon yercha berbina Yerushalayim beis mikdash chomzim hasoilo
Tziyon yercha berbina Yerushalayim beis mikdash chomzim hasoilo Tziyon yercha berbina
Now it's time for another classic story from our master storyteller, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser.
A man managed to escape with his family from Portugal during the Inquisition and reached Eretz Yisrael. Shortly after his arrival, he happened to be in the shul one Shabbos afternoon when the rabbi spoke about the special sacrifice of the 12 loaves, the lechem aponim, that the Kohanim brought in the Beis HaMikdash each week, and reminding his congregation that the Beis HaMikdash was no longer standing, the rabbi heaved a deep sigh. The man returned home and, in all innocence, told his wife that from now on she was to prepare 2 loaves from flour specially sifted. She was to knead the dough and bake it well. He wanted these loaves as a sacrifice for Hashem. The wife dutifully did exactly as her husband had said, and each Friday afternoon the man would bring the 2 challahs and place them before the Aron Kodesh, with a prayer that Hashem should accept them and have pleasure from them. The shamash of the shul, who came early in order to prepare the shul for Shabbos, would see these 2 challahs there each week. He thought that someone probably brought them for shalashudas the next afternoon, and he would put them away. When this man would return in the evening and saw that his challahs were gone, he felt that Hashem must have accepted them, and this caused him great joy. One time, however, the rabbi himself came to the shul. He wished to practice his speech by delivering it from the bima that week. He was standing there when the man entered with the 2 loaves of bread tucked under his arms. Without even noticing that there was anyone else present, he went over to the Aron as usual and poured out the feelings of his heart, begging Hashem to accept his gift. The rabbi had not breathed a word all this time. He was deeply shocked and too stunned to act. "Fool! Idiot! Do you really think that Hashem eats and drinks, that he accepts your loaves? It must be the shamash who took them mistakenly, thinking that they were for the next day. How could you ever have thought that Hashem would eat these loaves of bread?" The rabbi had just finished his remarks when the shamash entered to fetch his weekly loaves. Not noticing the 2 men, he walked over to the Aron and lifted the curtain. The rabbi stopped him. "Thank this man here for your fresh challahs," he said. "He has been bringing them here each week." The shamash murmured his thanks in confused, garbled tones. The rabbi now looked back at the man to see his reaction. The man had turned a pasty white. Tears were streaming down his cheeks. "Forgive me," he said to the rabbi. "I made a big mistake. I did not know. I misunderstood your sermon about the lechem aponim. I wanted to do a mitzvah. That was all. But instead, I made a great mistake." The tears came gushing forth faster and faster as he realized that his good intentions had been a great mistake. Suddenly, a person burst in on this scene, a messenger from the Ari HaKodesh who lived in Tzfas at that time. The messenger said to the rabbi, "You have caused a great, great sorrow in heaven, because since this person brought the challahs with such great joy to please Hashem, there was nothing as great in heaven as this." This is Rabbi Meir Goldwasser wishing you all a good Shabbos.
As we wrap up another Second Amendment edition of the Jewish Experience radio program, a couple of reminders. Full-service Jewish day camp with hot lunches and daily snacks and 6 weeks' worth of camp. Call Rabbi Shmuley Rothman for more information at 412-715-4883. And Jewish Perspectives on Conception and Pregnancy with Rabbi Levi Langers this Sunday. 7:30 p.m. at Congregation Polezedek. Tribute to the memory of Mr. Ed Lewis, 64th Annual Dinner, Yeshiva Schools. Call Mindy, 412-422-7300. Drs. Joel and Tova Weinberg, Kolel Annual Malava Manka Dinner, March 1st at 8:45 p.m. Call 412-420-0220. And ZOA Pittsburgh, in partnership with the UJF. Did Herzl really say that? Conversation Israel. Call Deborah at the ZOA for more information, 412-665-4630. And also they present, ZOA Pittsburgh's presenting I in Israel, six-part course. Again, call Deborah for more information on that, 412-665-4630. Don't forget, the Food Meeting of Food Addicts Recovery Anonymous keeps doing it, and they're very successful. Call Ilana for more information, 412-422-2224. Don't forget to call us if you'd like to have your Mazel Tovs on our program or your events. 412-979-5770. Can't forget that number. Or email jewishexperience@verizon.net by noon on Monday for that week's program. And we would like to thank Alan Gottlieb, director of the Second Amendment Foundation, among many, many, many other things he does, for impressing upon us the importance of ensuring that the Jewish community always has the right to keep and bear arms. And, of course, our faithful and cutting-edge staff, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser, Rabbi Yosef Eisen, Reb Moshe Pekar, Dr. Michael Shulman, Miss Devorah DeLynn, reporting from Israel, of course, Miss Pearlie DeLynn for selecting our music today, and our engineer, Jeremy LeBossenstein, for another outstanding show. Don't forget, candlelighting time, 5:36 p.m. It's been a lot of fun. I do have to run. Don't forget, Jewish Radio is here for you. Will you be here for Jewish Radio? Donate today at jewishexperience@verizon.net. Of course, you can always sponsor your favorite segment as well. Hi, I'm Hirsch DeLynn. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll see you all next week or before on the web at jewishexperienceradio.com anytime. And we'll be back here Friday, same Yiddish time, same Yiddish channel. See you then.